Welcome to another edition of Rose City Politics, where we inform, debate, discuss, and yes, sometimes even mock municipal issues in Windsor and Essex County. Sound off during the show through our Twitter account at RCP Windsor.
All right, and welcome to another edition of Rose City Politics. We were all kind of looking at each other, trying to figure out whose turn it was in the barrel this week.
And look at me. I'm still too busy getting used to the board and trying to run things.
I knew that was the case.
So the answer to that question...
I did last week, so... Yeah.
And don't look at me, because that's just a terrible idea.
So your reluctant host tonight is me, Doug Saratori, joined by Kieran McKenzie, taking selfies.
Yeah, I'm trying to get an Instagram post here.
Okay. Paul Sinnott working the board. There was a flurry of activity over there just a minute ago. Paul, what happened?
It's like, what was it, Airplane 1 or Airplane 2 when they disconnected the radar core? we had to find the disconnect part.
And Dangerous Don Merrifield, how's it going, Don?
I'm stressed out, but I'm good. I'm happy to be here and not dealing with flooded basements and real estate deals right now.
Yeah, that's got to be a complicating factor. More work and no more money, right?
Exactly. And we all know real estate agents don't get paid enough. Let's just put that out there.
Yeah, it's the story of your profession, right?
Look at all the sympathy I got.
Yeah,
right away.
We're all in tears here. Okay, so tonight we're going to we got a lot of topics we're going to try to get to. We're going to talk about the shenanigans in Essex, specifically at Essex Council. There have been more ejections and drama at Essex Town Council. We have an update on...
Well, this wrestling thing is starting to almost become a reality.
It is, right? Yeah.
It really digressed.
We had a police escort.
I know, that's worse.
That is just a very, very thin hair away from like a chair to the back of the head.
Yeah, no, I mean, they had to call the guys in from the back, right?
Yep. It's one step away from a cage match where all are going to be screened in.
Vokes off the turnbuckle. And... we're going to follow up on last week's discussion of Floodmageddon. We're going to talk about the city's response, the 8-point plan to fix the sewer system to prevent future floods.
Fabulous response.
And the scaling back of the $3 million Jackson Park Christmas light project. So all those topics are on the agenda for tonight. We've also... done a little bit of research on City Council's social media presence. So there's an opportunity for us to talk about the social media shenanigans of our councilors and our mayor. But first, we're going to start with a bit of breaking news. Today, the company that owns the Ambassador Bridge between Windsor and Detroit says it will replace the existing span now that the Canadian government has approved what bridge officials are calling the final permit. So there is a schedule of terms and conditions here that every single person around this table has read in detail, and there are several media reports, but what we're going to do here is get some instant reactions, and I'm going to start with the person who's the most likely to have the most interesting reaction. Kieran, is this something you thought about at all today?
I didn't think it was coming today. To be honest, I'm not even nearly as shocked as I think a lot of people are. This decision was made in 2014 when the environmental assessment was approved for the bridge enhancement project. That was a little bit surprising when that happened, and there was a lot of people in the community who were aware of that and who had expressed opinions about that.
If you go back and you look at the submissions that happened for that, in that time, there was a lot of stakeholders in the community that articulated a view on the bridge enhancement project, the twinning proposal. The surprise was that it came today. I still don't know exactly if there was a specific deadline that the government was up against. And then the other thing that was surprising is I'm going to just call it what it is. There's a lot of things for us to talk about as we move forward through this project. But what happened today was a totally, and I normally try to stay away from federal topics because it is sort of my day job, but the government really botched the announcement today. The the announcement, the community was originally apprised of this decision from the government to approve these permits by the bridge company themselves. That is irregular. This should have been, at the very least, it should have ended up on some kind of press release page on the government websites, and should have, and perhaps even could have been an announcement from the minister himself. Instead, sure, it was posted on the Privy Council. It was sort of buried on the Privy Council website and eventually made its way onto Transport Canada's media release by the end of the day. But at that point, the media was already well aware and people were making phone calls about this announcement because of a press release that came from the bridge company themselves. To the point, and I'll just say this for the bridge company, that press release was horribly written. It was as bad a piece of public relations work that I've seen in a long, long time. It was so bad, in fact, that a lot of us who were looking at this press release wondered if it was real or not. And there were some of us that spent a good half hour, 45 minutes trying to confirm through, you know, the official sources that this is actually something real or not some bizarre hoax that's coming from the bridge company, or even if the bridge company's servers had been hacked or something like that. It was bizarre. The way that the announcement came down, at least today, in terms of initial response, very bizarre. Still have yet to digest, Doug, a lot of what you see. You have the document in front of you, the terms and conditions of the permit itself. There's a lot in there. There's a lot in there to digest. But I think once people start reviewing it, for those that don't know what is on the table, Sandwich Town, after this project is completed, will not look anything like we remember it, particularly the northeast section of Sandwich Town. And then even a little further beyond into areas like the Bridgeview and even extending as far up as almost Tecumseh Road near here on Church, it's going to look a lot different than we know it now. And I'm not sure whether or not that's a good or a bad thing for the community. One thing I will say at this point, you know, we're seeing some federal investment into this area with the border project. I think this puts a lot of pressure on the federal government once again to be very cognizant of what's happening in this community, and they better be ready to write some big checks to mitigate the impacts of this border crossing, particularly allowing for the improvement of this particular crossing, the Ambassador Bridge, to happen in the middle of the community.
Okay, so one thing I'd like to try tonight, we always talk about engaging the community on our Twitter feed using our handle at RCP Windsor. Tonight, I think I'm particularly interested in hearing community reactions to the news about the twinning of the Ambassador Bridge. So throughout the show, no matter what the topic we're discussing, if you've got a reaction to this announcement about the bridge, we're interested in hearing it and sharing that with a wider audience. So go ahead and bring your comments to at RCP Windsor. Paul, what are your thoughts on the Ambassador Bridge announcement?
I'll kind of pick up on what Kieran had said. I mean, I didn't realize that it was the bridge himself that had announced it first, but I just found it was strange that it was done in this way, like just a quiet posting on the Privy Council website. I mean, it makes me wonder what the government was thinking and doing, because this isn't just a small construction announcement. This is a billion-dollar at least project, if not more, in other surrounding construction and everything that needs to happen. Governments don't hide billion-dollar announcements under a bushel. There's generally a minister there, big white checks, lots of hoopla. So I mean, I'm really curious why they did it in this manner. I mean, it just really, really surprises me, because there's a lot wrapped up in this. As we said, you know, the future of Sandwich Town, and it's going to drastically alter how Windsor looks and operates. There's discussions to be had now on community benefits, which I think is a good thing. Hopefully this resolve some of our rather acrimonious relationship with Mr. Maroon and his companies, because we need to move forward in some way. This, I think the process is in place now that he's going to have to present a plan for the burned out houses. Maybe, I don't know, maybe that will short circuit the Supreme Court ruling and shorten this process. So no, you got to feel for the people in Sandwich. They've endured this for years.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's tragic. The area looks horrible. We need to to look at moving forward in some positive way. And, you know, overall, I always thought it was going to happen anyways. There was, once he got that presidential permit and the Coast Guard permit on the U.S. side, it was pretty much, I think, a done deal here in Canada once the process was going through. And ultimately, I don't think it's a bad thing. I mean, I think having a bridge and a spare is right. It'll be a newer bridge. And the community benefits is really attracts me now. Because, again, this is something relatively new to Canada and big construction projects like this. Now is the time to have a serious discussion about what those community benefits are going to be. From what I understand, I think we missed out an opportunity on the public bridge. There wasn't the engagement they thought, to the point where I believe it was Dinan Way that jumped in and tried to lead the way on the community projects. They're very commonplace in the States for almost all these type of construction projects. This is an opportunity for Windsor to shoot for the moon and get as much as we can to mitigate some of these impacts. So I think it's something we definitely have to keep our eye on in the future.
Donald, your thoughts on the bridge?
Well, let me say I agree with almost everything except what Kieran says. And it's not that I don't actually, it's just more of a moral position, I take.
Come on, the government bashing at least. I mean,
that's true. We're on side. Yeah, I guess just to reiterate what you guys said, the announcement was weird. Like Paul says, usually when it's a huge, huge infrastructure investment project like that, you're going to see, you know, you're going to get messages that, you know, so-and-so's coming down, there's going to be cutting ribbons, and they're going to fly F-15s over top and all that kind of stuff. I guess, you know, it was going to happen sooner or later. I actually think in the long term, this is going to be the best thing that ever happened to Sandwich Town, because the situation it's in now wasn't sustainable. It's hurting people who own homes down there. I think at the end of the day, this is actually going to be better for the homeowners, and not only the people who are affected by Indian Road and just going to be in the general vicinity of where all the construction is going to happen. The interim control bylaw was put in basically to stop the bridge from tearing down all those houses. But a side effect of this is anyone who lived in this area who wanted to actually improve their property got wrapped up in this. There were a lot of garages that are falling down that couldn't be torn down because they were quote-unquote heritage. And if we let them do it, we have to let everybody do it. I think once we get the process going, get rid of that interim control bylaw, not only is the Indian Road situation going to be resolved, whether you like how it's going to be resolved or not, it's going to be resolved. And now other members of the community who actually want to improve their properties now will have the ability to do it. I think that's going to be the biggest benefit, you know, outside of the whole bridge situation. I think that's a very big auxiliary kind of spin-off thing that's going to really help the area.
And who's the small developer that's been held up? Is it Kevin Flood?
Hillary Payne? No, it is Kevin Flood, actually.
It is Kevin Flood. I know he focuses on smaller developments in areas, and I think he had a couple properties that he wanted to demolish so he could build new housing, which the West End could use, and this has held him up for years.
Yeah, I'm a little bit concerned about the viability of Sandwich Town and the community west of the bridge, especially if you think about the time period that we're going to have between the building of the new bridge and the demolishing of the old. That's a significant gap and a significant separation from the rest of the community. And so, you know, that's where my thoughts are tonight, is really on Sandwich Town and the folks in Sandwich Town who have endured, as you guys have alluded to, they've endured so much over the years and so many missed opportunities and so many sort of disappointing developments along the way. I understand the perspective that we're going to end up with something that is an improvement on the current situation, not just because of the relationship with the operator of the bridge, but also with you know, the sort of frozen stasis that parts of the community are in. But, you know, if you, you know, and I know, I think all you guys are from here except for Paul, but if you remember, the West End didn't used to be like this. I certainly remember, you know, even in my university days, which is a long time ago now, that The West End was a different and much more vibrant community, and it looks like those days are never coming back. So, and maybe it's true that this is just the final nail in the coffin, but it certainly is a time for, you know, reflecting on what the West End was and what it's likely to ever be again. That's kind of where I sit on it.
You don't think it can come back just on a smaller scale? Obviously, there's fewer houses there.
I think it's the problem now is that is it not going to be better connected to LaSalle than it is to the rest of Windsor?
I don't know. It's hard because we haven't got any concrete plans.
We haven't seen drawings yet.
But yeah. I mean, ultimately, from the sound of some of the conditions that they put on it, that they have to build a new street, even though it's east of the bridge, they have to build a new street connecting Wyandotte to College. It's hard to imagine it being more cut off right now than what it is. Depends on how they manage that traffic.
We'll have to spend some time poring over Google Maps and.
By the way,
there's a potential for things like, I mean, you know, could they require like an underpass for the better flow of traffic crossways? Or
there's a lot of things that they need to consider. I mean, think about the at grade rail.
Right.
That's right in front of the crossing.
Oh, terminal rail.
Yeah,
line.
Yeah. Yes. So I mean, yes. What kind of an idiot builds a border in front of an at-grade rail crossing in the first place, right? So here's the opportunity to address that problem.
Yes.
The question of bisecting the community again, no question about it. And to your point, Don, about this like becoming the opportunity for the next chapter, it's a point well taken, but it's just not going to happen because we're moving on to the next phase. This is the thing that... this community's fought a long time to get the crossing in the first place, to put this issue as it was quote-unquote Canada's top infrastructure priority. That didn't happen because somebody in Ottawa woke up one day and said, hey, I think we should do something about Windsor. It was advocacy in this community. We got to do it all again. And in order to be able to get this project and have this project built in a way that's fair for this community, this is the Green Link fight, this is the border fight, this is this is just another round in all of that, and it's going to be knocked down, drag out. It is going to be hard fought. Yes, opportunity is there to improve the lives of the people who have been impacted by this border fiasco for a long, long time, but it's going to take a lot of heavy lifting and a lot of hard work, and I think we're up to it. But I think people need to understand what's ahead.
Are we up to it though? That was the question I was going to kind of throw to everybody. What does everybody around here? Do we have the right council right now to do that fight?
No.
Well, Don answered the question.
Just think on that a little bit, though.
To Kieran's point, this is something that comes down to strength of leadership. And I think that if there's one thing that's clearly lacking on council right now, it's organized leadership with vision and with backbone that is able to take on this kind of fight. So in the absence of at least for the next 18 months or so, in the absence of effective elected representation, at the municipal level, what's the alternative?
I agree, because as much as in the beginning I was actually against Mayor Francis and the whole Greenlink idea and a lot of the moves they did, hiring David Estrin, the high-priced lawyer out of Toronto, Gridlock Sam, and everything else. But you look at that epic fight, and that cost us, $12, $13 million over the years. You know what? Ultimately, I have to take my hat off to him. He got it right, and we got the Herb Gray Park.
We won. Won that fight.
Yep. And, I got to take my hat off to him. Like I said, I started off initially really, really opposed to that. That's what concerns me.
Hard to see it any other way. I agree, Paul.
Well, we did lose four sets of great Christmas lights for that cost.
I think it's worth it. I will say this. The question of leadership at the municipal level is out there. The thing is that this community has champions and border champions in it at the grassroots level that have been highly effective. The only thing that troubles me when I think about it, here I might coin a new term, is border fatigue. Are we tired of this fight? And I think the answer is yes, we are tired of this fight. But
it's going to be a different fight now, though.
in some respects, but it does. I mean, we're going to go back to fairness on the expropriation piece.
Sure.
We fought that for all of the people in South Windsor who got expropriated, and the people in the Spring Garden area. All of that is coming back. You have the community benefits. What are those going to look like? Where they're going to be? What responsibilities does the federal government have on an ongoing basis now that they've made the active decision to allow for a major piece of border infrastructure to exist within a densely populated, urbanized environment? Does a city have the responsibility to maintain that infrastructure that is going to host all of that they currently have the responsibility to do? These aren't simple questions. They're not going to be, the federal government is just going to walk in and say, okay, we'll take this off your hands. We'll make sure everybody gets dealt with perfectly, fairly. The bridge company isn't going to go through their expropriation process where they're going to try to make sure that everybody gets full value for whatever land that they're going to have to give up. And then the other pieces, the unanticipated impacts, who knows? So all I'm saying is there's going to be some things that are familiar. It is a new fight. There'll be new issues, no question, and there's new funding sources with what's in the International Bridges and Tunnels Act. The requirement for the community benefits is actually legislated. So, yes, there's reasons to be optimistic. There's also some very serious and significant reasons to be deeply, deeply concerned. And now, for the community generally, even after 15 years of this, is not the time for us to take our eye off the ball at any level.
Don't you think a lot of people in the community now will be a lot more engaged than they were before?
I hope so.
Because the big fight always was, do we want the bridge? I mean, there's a lot of people that just kind of started to roll their eyes, go, look, these issues are too big for me as an individual homeowner. But now the process is going to be started, and it's going to be, what's going to happen to my street? Is there going to be a park down here? So I think the community will be advocating and a lot more involved than they have been up to this point, because the big issue is kind of, flying over everybody's head. And not only that, I think from the city standpoint, we've talked on this show and I've said some pretty mean things about what has happened to the West End. They're not going to be able to ignore the West End anymore.
Sure.
Because it's going to be now, it's like the Herb Gray Parkway. This is going to be a big project where you can't just turn a blind eye to this whole area. The city's going to have to be engaged. They can't just keep ripping crap out of there like they have been for years. They're going to be forced to actually deal with what are we putting in here for the long term. And I think, up to this point, like I said, I think it's been ignored, and I think we've just kind of sloughed off the West End from a mayor and council point, and I don't think they'll be able to ignore it anymore. I think that's actually going to work out to their benefit down there.
Yeah, a funny thing that just occurred to me, though, too. I mean, when you talk about bridge fatigue and everything else, it's certainly a time-worn strategy that's worked well for Matty Maroon. I mean, he's essentially 2-0 in fighting the Canadian government. When he fought the bridge, the government tried to basically take ownership of it from him. He sued the federal government, starting under Pierre Trudeau, and it carried on for 22-some-odd years, and it wasn't settled until near the end of Brian Mulroney that he got to keep it and have it stay in private hands. Now, I mean, what he started, this started under, was it started under Chrétien? Or it started under Harper? I mean, again, through another two prime ministers, three prime ministers.
Chrétien.
It did start under Chrétien?
Yeah.
Okay. So now through three prime ministers, and, he's won again.
Hmm.
So basically it's the Trudeau family's fault.
Well, okay, I'm gonna take issue with that. I'll give him the two that you're giving him, but he lost on the New Crossing to begin with. He lost big time on the referendum in Michigan. He's lost he lost by going to jail. I mean,
sure.
He's lost many battles. The guy is not a genius. He is a very self-interested person who has pushed an issue to the nth degree with unlimited resources to protect his own personal best interests. And he's won some and he's lost some. And to the community's credit, we've been able to, on the big picture, the New Crossing, we've been able to beat this guy who has unlimited resources because we fought and won. So I just take issue with him being 2-0. He's not undefeated. He's taken some knocks in his own right.
Yeah.
Okay. So that was the 5-minute segment. That's okay. All right. Let's talk Floodmageddon 2, the flooding.
All right.
Okay.
Ooh. Flooding.
That's awesome.
Mayor Drew Dilkins presented an 8-point sewer plan during Tuesday's council meeting with the aim of taking on future storms following the worst flood in the city's history. So at some point, I think this is just a point I want to make, at some point between Monday and Tuesday of last week, this flood went from being sort of no big deal, not as bad as last year,
people.
To being the worst flooding in the city's history. So those 311 calls are important, guys. More than 5,000 basements were soaked in the city of Windsor after heavy rainfall hit several neighborhoods and flooded streets. And I also want to point out that this 8-point plan comes after, also after the sort of the narrative was put forward that there was nothing that we could do. There was nothing that we could possibly have done differently. So those 8 points are a review of development policies in conjunction with the town of Tecumseh as it relates to sewer management. The city will now cover 100% of the cost to install a backflow valve and sump pump through the basement protection subsidy, placing a priority on homeowners looking to take advantage of the program who have already had a flood, almost everybody. The disconnection of weeping tiles from sanitary to storm sewers is included in the subsidy program. The city staff will look at following the lead of the town of LaSalle by adding sewage ejection pumps to the program, and possibly include them in future development projects. Downspout disconnects are now going to be mandatory, and the City of Windsor will cover the costs associated with downspout disconnection. Expediting sewer work at the Riverside Vista project between St. Rose and Ford Boulevard, that's about a $7 million increase on what's already budgeted. And expediting the sewer master plan. Phase one includes a camera inspection of every single section of the sewer system in the city, as well as flow monitoring. Okay, and the final part of the plan circles back to what mayors from the region asked of Ontario Premier Kathleen Wynne last week, a provincial insurance plan. And I just want to point out that all of our stories tonight come from CBC News Windsor, and there was a liberal reading of CBC's copy there, and thanks very much, guys. So reactions to the 8-point plan. I want to start with Paul on this one, because Paul, I saw you had a really interesting post on this today, and I want to kind of get your reaction here on it.
Well, you kind of alluded to it in the leadoff. I mean, a lot of these are things. It's not a new plan in a lot of ways. A lot of these have been on the books at the City of Windsor for a while. We just haven't moved forward with them. Specifically, the mandatory downspout is kind of a hobby horse of mine. I've been calling for it to be mandatory for years. I believe it's 2008 when we drafted the downspout disconnection policy, so almost 10 years. It's 2012 when we started the voluntary disconnection program with one area there in South Walkerville around the Howard area that was actually mandatory. So, I mean, what haven't we figured out in 5 years that the voluntary program wasn't working? It was a very low uptake. When all reports say it was a very cost-effective method of, it's not a silver bullet, but it helps reduce the problem. I think it's a 15 to 20% reduction if all the downspouts are disconnected. So when councillors are saying that there's nothing they could have done, I mean, I posted on my page, if I remember, I'll post on the Rose City Politics page. Councillor Hull asked the question in 2015. It was reported back on in January of 2016 at the Environment Committee, asking what were the benefits of a mandatory downspout disconnection program. There were clear benefits, and the only negatives were it would increase calls to 311 and complaints, and there was some associated cost. They voted to receive. He tried to get support in order to move forward with the mandatory. He didn't have the support on council, so they voted to basically note and receive the report and do nothing. That's 18 months ago.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's a long time ago that could have been in place. The weeping tile section, again, not new. Tecumseh has been doing a subsidy program. I believe theirs is at 50% to disconnect the weeping tiles. And again, not a really high dollar item overall, but a high, high value return. It's not in the $60 million range that the mayor is talking about. Those are the major new catch basins, larger sewers, or whatever else. These are all things that could have been done last October after the last flood and could have been in play. No, it wouldn't have affected, it wouldn't have stopped this flood, but it would have mitigated it, and maybe some neighborhoods wouldn't have flooded this time if we had been more aggressive.
Well, and that's a really good point, and before I'm going to go to Kieran next, but before I do that, I just want to mention that I think one thing that I want to make sure is not lost in all this is the value and the power of community engagement. The level of engagement we saw because we beat this issue to death last week talking about the juxtaposition between the floods and the Christmas lights, but the reaction that catalyzed got things done. Things that have been sitting on the back burner for 18 months and even longer, and enduring a flood last year did not motivate us to act until the political will was there and until the community reacted with a lot of activity and energy.
And kudos again to, was it Brent Henderson, I believe, was the young gentleman who started the petition. And the last time I looked, it was almost 6,100 signatures. Yeah. I mean, I know, there's without a doubt, that's a record in Windsor municipal politics for a politician. For a petition. I've never, ever seen that.
In terms of the time frame to get
this. Oh, especially, the Ojibwe, the Save Ojibwe petition, I think, was around 2,800. And they were their butts off for a year to get those 2,800 signatures.
Yeah, those are good numbers. So, Kieran, what are your thoughts?
So, I think that the mayor, remind me when the piece came out where basically they sent Mr. Winterton, the chief engineer, or the city engineer out there to say basically there's nothing that we could have done. I think that was on Thursday of last week, right?
Mm-hmm. Somewhere on there.
So that was the last of the complete and total disaster, shameful communication strategy that was coming out of City Hall. That was the cherry on top of the icing
on this issue.
On this issue, yeah. No, you're right.
There's always more.
The initial response to the flood was nothing short of, what can I say?
Pathetic.
Pathetic is a great word.
Yeah.
It was insulting, aggravating, infuriating.
Very condescending to the whole community.
That's right. So,
like I said, very tone deaf in approach and in everything.
But from that point forward, and I have to say this, I think the 8-point plan that we saw from the mayor, and yes, it's dusting off and an amalgamation of a bunch of different things, he doesn't need to reinvent the wheel, but what I do appreciate from the mayor and from the leadership at City Council is that they did have enough magnanimity, if you will, to climb off the mountain, to actually listen, and to start doing things in the community that A, sound like you're doing the right thing, and to give people an idea that we can build and show some leadership and rebuild from this disaster. And this is how we're going to do it. I think the mayor's had a good couple of days in terms of what he's said, and he's actually shown the leadership that I think all of us were hoping, we're talking about last week in terms of it being absent. So it's starting to happen. I think the 8-point plan, I'm not an engineer myself. My knowledge of construction and whatnot is extremely limited. It sounds like he is proposing to do the things that need to be done in order to put us in the best position going forward. Why that wasn't done earlier, okay, we can quibble about that. And it's not just quibble. Let's have some real serious discussions about why this didn't happen after the last flood. But now, at the very least, we are seeing the leadership that I think we needed to see. And I want to congratulate the mayor for doing that at this time.
Yep, I'd agree. It's good to see that there is a substantive response, and it has the appearance of being an appropriate immediate response. I think what I'd like to see going forward is maybe dusting off our climate change plan and taking a look at what elements from that plan need to be accelerated or put on the table in terms of implementation so that we can better prepare this community.
I think all those 8 points are six of the 8 points are in that climate
change plan. The only piece I would add to that, to the plan that I think needs to be added beyond some of the technical aspects. So they talk about a provincial insurance program, and I think that makes Don, if he had hair, would he would be lighting it on fire. back to the jokes.
We're getting to the bald jokes again. It's all starting.
But there needs to be greater engagement with senior levels of government on the range of programs that are available for disaster mitigation. So not just the discussion about, geez, no one gets insurance in Windsor anymore because of what we've seen happen.
Right.
It's where are the shortcomings in the existing programming? Because this is not just a Windsor Essex County problem. Climate change related cataclysmic weather events are now a reality going forward, and is going to need full engagement from all levels of government in order for us collectively to be able to mitigate those issues.
Okay, Don, before we go to break, do you have a quip or a substantial comment on this issue?
I'll just say dumbass. I'm not gonna love it. No, I guess to be real quick, this is a great response. My question is, why wasn't this the first response? Why does the mayor and council and administration have to be dragged kicking and screaming to actually say something that means something to the community, as opposed to insulting people and just sloughing it off of, you know, look at the towels I have in my basement, I feel your pain? I mean, that's bullshit if you ask me. I think the fact that this wasn't done after the last flood, it's nice it's happening now, but explain that to the 5,000 people who maybe didn't have to have flooded basements this time, who are now going to be spending tens of thousands of dollars
sure.
to redo this again. If we look at the money that we had this discussion line is wasted, look, we've had a $10 million slush fund for years now. The Vista project, they're saying, well, it isn't finished because it costs $7 million. It's not even 1 year of the enhanced capital budget. $3 million on the stupid Christmas lights that we're going to spend anyway. We're going to get to that later. A backflow valve costs about $1,500 per house. Maybe two. Let's give them $2,000. How many backflow valves can we install? How many of those 5,000 people would not have flooded basements if the city just said, you know, instead of Christmas lights or enhanced capital budgets every year, we're actually going to deal with the real issues of infrastructure in this city, which everybody has been complaining about since Mayor Francis, because Mayor Francis had to justify everything, saying, well, you can't have a city just on infrastructure alone. That's not how it works. So, you know, great it's coming out now. I am pissed off this didn't happen a long time ago. And these are some easy solutions with not a lot of money that we've been spending on other stuff, on frivolous items. Now, hopefully, we're going to be forced to deal with this because it's happened twice. I don't know.
Okay, so to sum up, Don's still angry. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back.
Thank you.
Okay, so welcome back to Rose City Politics. Just to quickly recap the panel, I'm Doug Sartori, joined by Dangerous Don Merrifield, Powerful Paul Sinnott, and Crazy Kieran McKenzie.
You're crazy. Come on.
Going into the break, well, you know, we got a K word. We got to find something with a K. So you're crazy, like
cutting.
In homage to the Windsor classic,
it's
Crazy
the Rose
Kellys.
City Politics Morning Zoo Crew here.
Yeah. Yeah, we need those sound effects a little bit. At least, at the very least, I need a bike horn over here. So before the break, we had Angry Don, and now we are going to segue into Ranting Kieran.
Ranting
so
Kieran.
Kieran has a rant.
Okay, so happy belated Labor Day to everybody. I hope you all enjoyed. Everybody enjoyed the day off that that they enjoyed on Monday, and that day off comes as a result of the advocacy that folks in the labor community have done for generations. Weekends off, a 40-hour work week, overtime, pensions, a lot of these things that we enjoy and we think are just, you know, a normal part of everyday life were hard-fought battles, and battles that the labor community was front and center to for and securing for, not just for people who were part of a union, but for working people all over the world and in Canada specifically. So that was what that's what the Labor Day celebration was about. And what I was disappointed about, where the rant is coming from, is that there was 5,000 people who marched in the Labor Day parade and who gathered where they always do at the Fogelaar Furlan to sort of rally and talk about the great strides that working people have made in the community over the last year and over, and acknowledge some of the people who have passed and the great activists individually. And what we didn't see there, we had everybody from senior levels of government there. What we didn't see was a single person elected at the municipal level of government. And I think that was an absolute travesty, that of the 11 people who are elected to council and the mayor, nobody was able to attend this this event. Again, 5,000 people from your community, from a stakeholder group that is a very important stakeholder group in your community, and nobody can find a couple of hours to attend. And especially what I find baffling, absolutely like stunning, I'm stunningly baffled, if you will, is that it's a free podium with thousands of people. You will be invited on stage. You will be you will have the opportunity to say something profound for once in your life, in front of a large group of people.
For once in your life,
and you just pass on that. I think it's I think it's unfortunate. I think it's short-sighted. And you know, I know what I'm going to hear. Oh, I got this. I got that. We were never invited. You don't have to be invited. You do not have to be invited. And if you have to be invited to show up at any event that is important in the community, maybe you need to reconsider whether or not you should be representing people in this community in the first place.
Just to interject a little bit, this, I think, can be directed at county council as well, because this is it's sponsored by the Windsor and District Labor Council, right?
Correct.
Not just the Windsor.
Correct.
Were there any Tecumseh, LaSalle County Councils?
I did not. So I don't want to throw entire... because there may have been, and there would people.
Not none of them spoke though. You would have.
There was no one on stage who spoke. Who was elected at the municipal level of government at all?
Well, Councillor Volks wanted to speak, but he was shut down. Real quick.
So there's my rant. Just, you know what? And now to turn it up, just come out next year.
Yeah.
And you know what? I hope we'll see, I'm sure we're going to see a lot of them because it'll be election year.
All of a sudden, everybody's
yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's well, it is fascinating to think about why you know there's 11 people at play here. Why none of them saw a political benefit to being in attendance at this event?
The politics of it.
Well, there's a number of different possible reasons, and it is interesting.
I mean, I was busy showing houses to a guy who works for the provincial government, but you know, everybody else could have went.
Everybody else could have went. Okay, next up on the agenda, Mayor scales back $3 million Jackson Park lights project following floods. So as part of what Kieran characterized as Mayor Drew Dilkin's good couple of days, the mayor said council will revisit the decision to install a multi-million dollar Christmas display in Jackson Park, a decision made just hours before thousands of basements flooded across the city. Again, these comments come from CBC News. Dilkin said the city will scale back and phase in the Jackson Park display, which was expected to cost $3 million. while speaking to reporters, he didn't offer details, but while speaking to reporters, he suggested that the council could keep the project to $1.5 million. So we have a slightly diminished, smaller version of the incredible Christmas lights display in Jackson Park. Don, what do you think?
Well, I was interested in somewhere in that story, and I was going to ask you if you could find it, but
sure.
He actually describes what the display was, and I believe it was a giant, beautiful Christmas tree and all these sorts of things.
This is the CBC piece. It's a pretty small piece.
Yeah, okay, maybe it was in the Windsor Star piece, but he does at one point describe what it is. So we're talking a big, giant Christmas tree, you know, Santa's reindeer, all that kind of stuff. And it brings me back to Councillor Paul Borelli talking about how this can be used for Hanukkah celebrations,
Kwanzaa.
Be used for
powwows,
Kwanzaa. I'm sure he picked, you know, I'm sure there's a Hindu festival in there somewhere. That's the first thing that struck me as ridiculous. But to go to this, if I'm not mistaken, when we discussed this last week, somebody had brought up, and it was in the Windsor Star piece again, the company that actually does these displays had said they couldn't get a display out in the, at this time anyway because it's too late.
Yeah.
So he couldn't spend the money even if he wanted to, unless he went down to the dollar store and went insane. So he's making this, in my opinion, the mayor's making this sound like he's seen the light, he's had a come-to-God moment, and he realized he's doing what the community wants him to do, when the reality was he couldn't do what he wanted to do in the first place, and this was always going to be the outcome.
Might be making a little bit of lemonade out of a lemon there.
Exactly.
And, it's an interesting point that you make. Anybody else want to weigh in on the Christmas lights issue?
Well, I just 100% agree with you. I think that there's no doubt. I will say this. Whether or not they were going to be able to get the lights that they wanted to or not, I think there's a part of me that it occurred to the leadership at City Hall that, you know, once again, these are the naysayers. It's a small group. We're going to stick to our guns. I think that idea, that strategy was considered. And even if they weren't going to spend the $3 million, they were just going to continue to say they were going to spend the $3 million because out of just sheer stubbornness.
Oh, for sure.
But I think they may have had, I don't want to call it a come-to-Jesus moment, but, like, again, I think they're having a good week in terms of being, again, magnanimous, recognizing that they, and maybe it's just healthy self-interest, whatever it might be. The mayor did something good this week. I don't want to be that guy that's going to pile on even when they do something good. Although I don't disagree with what you just said.
I'm going to be that guy because somewhere in that story, right near the end, they threw this in, and I don't think a lot of people really, you know, caught the small picture when we're looking at the big picture. Someone from the city said it's going to cost $300,000 a year to maintain this display.
Mm-hmm.
So this isn't just costing $3 million. This is $300,000 a year that now can't be spent on X, Y, and Z, and we can use flood mitigation things right now. $300,000 gets you about 200 backflow valves every year. So again, we've made a choice where this is more important than taking care of basic infrastructure.
So just in case you think that Don has absolutely no filter, when Kieran said come to Jesus, I happened to be watching Don's face, and I saw his lips move, and he just thought better of it. The guy does have a filter.
I had a really good one in my head.
Tell us after. Paul, what are your thoughts on the Christmas lights?
I'm not going to be magnanimous at all. I mean, I think it's still a wrong-headed decision. I still think it's a $1.5 million waste of money instead of a $3 million waste of money. Again, the only experts from the Windsor Star contacted for their piece, one of the leading experts who designs these things says it's the absolute wrong location. I agree. Jackson Park is the wrong place for this. It's disconnected from any BIA, from any business district. I don't see the benefit of this. Personally, I think it should be on the riverfront, and it can expand from one end of the city to the other. Far more encompassing in that way. Started off with a reasonable $200,000, $250,000 display and build on it year over year. Do what Kingsville has done. Follow their example. Build it up year over year. Add a new display each year. Build community partnerships. Get the sponsorships. $1.5 million is still a waste. And the other thing I thought, I mean, the whole concept, again, this is found money. Don't forget, the $1 million dividend from Enwin is the city giving itself money. Because
It's a city. It's 100% city-owned municipal corporation. The city appoints all the board members. The mayor is chair of one of them. I think he's on all of the boards there at Enwin. $1 million is essentially the dividend they give to the city almost every year. So that's not new money. The casino money is new money. This is the benefit we get. It was supposed to alleviate the societal cost of hosting the casino in the city of Windsor. It fluctuates. Sometimes if business is slow, it goes down a bit, it goes up a little bit. So the fact that this is found money that they can spend or whatever else, again, it's just kind of another fallacy that's being kind of built in to sell this project. I remain completely and utterly opposed to this, especially since the mayor now says his stated goal is in the future, after the new Windsor Hall opens, is to move it down there. So why not start at the river in that area and move up to encompass the Windsor Hall to join the two together or something like that? Just remain completely opposed.
I think the point you make about building something up gradually over time is a really good one. And I really like the idea of finding community partners. I mean, the a lights display at Christmas time, a holiday light display, could be a signature event and a signature organizing opportunity for a community organization. Kingsville does it in cooperation with the high school. And it really could be an opportunity to engage people in the community and do something right and do something over time. Unfortunately, that's not the direction that that they chose to go. But this seems to be a very evolving policy and spending initiative. So who knows where it will go from here. Anyway, finally, moving on. And it looks like we are, I don't know if you happen to have our Hay County theme music queued up, Paul, but we are going to head out to Essex Town Council.
I could listen to that all night.
Let's talk about the latest episode in the developing soap opera that is Essex Town Council. And again, this comes from CBC. Essex Town Council has voted to suspend Councillor Randy Vogt's pay for 2 months following a report from the Integrity Commissioner, who was then escorted from the fiery meeting by police. I'm just going to read some of these quotes because they are, I think they will provide some good context for discussion. Council's decision came after a recommendation from Commissioner Robert Swayze, but when Vokes tried to ask him some questions, he was told to leave the meeting by Mayor Ron McDermott. So Mayor McDermott's position was that it would be irregular for Councillor Vokes to ask those questions at that time. And here is Vokes' quote. The mayor said, "No, you can't." And I asked him, "Why not?" And he said, "Because I'm not letting you," said Vokes, who was met by a group of supporters outside council chambers. He said, "Tell council you're sorry or else you're going to have to leave." So I just never said a word. I just got up and walked out because I'm not sorry. I ain't close to being sorry. So that's a direct quote from Councillor Vokes. Yeah. So, and just to be fair and give some balance, McDermott's quote, he's fed up with Vokes and his behavior. This is the quote from McDermott. He doesn't have to follow rules. Well, he's gonna. That's why he had everyone put a complaint in against him, said the mayor. You know, you're either going to follow them or you're not. So it'll happen again. We'll take all his money if that's what he wants. Things are not getting better in Essex. So.
I'm curious right up front, though.
Do you guys see the video?
Yes.
I did, too.
Does council have the power? Does the mayor on his own have the power to demand an apology, and if not, eject them? Well, does that not require at least a full council vote and a motion?
Today I was listening to, they had audio of the mayor, the CBC did, on the morning show. And the Mayor McDermott is out there saying, "I saved Councillor Vogt's
job." Yeah, I heard that. Yeah.
So I thought that was a really bizarre thing to say. Yeah. It implies that he has the power to remove him altogether from council. which I think is bizarre.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that he has that power.
That I know he definitely does not.
So, I mean, maybe he's saying I could just bar him from council chambers and then he could he would effectively be removed from council. And he, in fact, went on to say that he had defended Councillor Vokes on numerous occasions and, like I said, saved his job. I guess, to me, something's got to give here. I don't think it's sustainable. I don't think they can make it through the next 18 months.
We've been saying that for a while.
Yeah. So what the solution is, I don't know. And it certainly looks like, you know, there's no coming back. The one question I will ask is I want to know procedurally who was correct on this, because somebody is correct and somebody's not correct.
Yeah.
Wasn't the situation is he wanted to ask questions after the vote and everything was done, as opposed to doing it before that?
That's it. And if that's the case, and I want to make the reason, so I think that's correct.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want to be not sure about it, but since it's out there now, that's the case, then I mean, Councillor Vokes would know that he was asking to do something that was out of order, and he should have realized also, given the relationship, that he wasn't going to be given any kind of like broad leeway to like do something that doesn't fall within the actual rules of order for them in terms of how they proceed. So, you know, I hate seeing this. I don't think it's constructive for the people of the community of Essex at all. In fact, it's incredibly destructive and divisive. I think I came down on the side of the mayor and was condemning Vokes a little bit, and I think I'm there in the same, I'm in the same universe again on this one. It doesn't seem to me that he's trying to help himself, and what I don't like about it is that I feel like he would have known that he wouldn't have been able to ask the integrity commissioner at that time, at that stage in the meeting. So it seems to me like he almost would have set that up, knowing he was going to be be cast in the victim role.
I think that a lot and of
that staged. Is conniving, exactly. And I think it was deliberate to some degree.
Well, there's also another kind of side topic to this. Just purely by accident, I had seen something on Facebook that day. There's a group of people in the community who are actively encouraging this kind of behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And when this happens, there's a, hey, let's go out and support our guy. He's in trouble today, and you know this whole ruling's coming down. Let's go to council, and basically let's cause trouble. Nobody's helping the situation here. The community, there's a community group, and I'm not going to even say who they are because I don't even have that discussion. But there's an organized community group who is actively supporting this kind of behavior and kind of encouraging this kind of behavior. And the only people who are paying the price in all this is anybody who lives in Essex.
Yeah,
because I don't know the situation with Mr. McDermott and Mr. Vokes. They could both be insane nut jobs, or they could be the nicest guys in the world. I know nothing about it. But what I do know is they're not doing their jobs. This has become a distraction to council where nothing is getting done now. And as I said, there are certain groups in the community who are encouraging this, either because they like it, they think it's entertaining, or this is just, I have no idea why you would be encouraging this kind of behavior.
I thought that some of the things that happened that we saw in video from council, Essex Council last night, were concerning, and one of them was the comments and the shouts coming from members of the audience who were leaving with Randy Vokes, because it sure did seem like folks attended the council meeting with the intent of being vocal supporters and maybe disrupting the meeting if they needed to, and they did do that. That's really not okay. And to Kieran's point, you know, you're 100% right. Something's got to give, because this is going to a bad place. This is going to a place that it does not need to go at all. And I think that the best thing that could happen is some resignations need to happen from council, because I just don't think like there's been ample opportunity here for this to be resolved. They've had mediators, they've had sanctions put on Mr. Vokes. I think, you know, to your point, Don, I don't know the ins and outs of the relationships. I don't go to Essex council meetings, you know, but this is not going to be resolved until someone's gone.
In credence.
But do you think that report that complaint is filed if the only thing that it includes is questionable stairs. I mean, sure, maybe there was some piling on, and maybe there was some fabrication of additional evidence or whatever, but at the end of the day, the issues are documented.
I agree. I mean, I think there is certain validity, and I think Councillor Vokes absolutely has to either reform or resign, but I'm still not willing to put it all on him. I mean, this is obviously a vendetta between Councillor Vokes and Mayor McDermott, and it's completely personal. I just want to mention, I don't know if anybody else noticed it tonight, it's getting ridiculous, and something happened that I'm completely against at any level in Canadian politics. One of the councillors, Councillor Bjorkman, his wife owns a business in Essex. And again, some of these vocal supporters of Councillor Vokes are trying to organize a boycott campaign against her business. I think that's absolutely out of bounds. It's horrendous. His wife, his spouse, his relatives have absolutely nothing to do with this battle and his votes for or against anybody. And I would encourage somebody to think twice before they share that kind of crap and encourage it. Because, I mean, just like when strikers at the university, picketed in front of Mr. Wildman's home. Those things are completely out of bounds. In Canadian politics, it may be acceptable in the States and other places. It's not acceptable in Canada to involve family, to involve children, and they don't belong.
Yeah, going after the spouse's business and organizing a boycott of the spouse of, and that's, by the way, that is Vokes' colleague as a Ward 1 councillor. They're both Ward 1 councillors, so...
I think it's disgusting.
Yeah,
disgusting.
I don't disagree, and just to go back to my earlier point, sometimes showing leadership means doing something that sucks.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if you don't want to be responsible or partially responsible or in some way responsible for some really bad stuff happening, you need to de-escalate your supporters, and you need to get folks to calm down, and if that means walking away from it, then maybe that's what he has to do.
Pretty soon, Kim Jong Vokes will be launching missiles from the parking lot over top of Essex County Council building.
Okay,
that might be a good last word.
Yeah, I think it is. All right, thanks for listening, guys.
Thank you for joining us for another episode of Rose City Politics. Don't forget to follow us on Facebook. Just search for Rose City Politics. On Twitter, at RCP Windsor. Or visit us at rosecitypolitics.ca. If you enjoy the show, please consider becoming a Patreon subscriber to help support production costs. You'll find the link on the homepage of Rose City Politics. Until next week.